Last time you were just about to begin talking about this collaboration.
Yes, that was it. Dr. McCollum made contact with Dr. Howland. Now, I think I didn't mention him. He was the head of the pediatrics there at Johns Hopkins, and they had, he and Dr. Park and Dr. Shipley had all been very interested in this clinical aspect because, of course, a good deal was known as a background of rickets. That is, they knew already that there was something very particular about fish oils. They had studied the field, and they knew, for instance, that in some offshore islands where they produced fish oils for sale, the inhabitants ate the heads. They made a kind of a stew with oatmeal. I believe this was up in Scotland. And they made a stew of fish heads and oatmeal. It sounds thrilling, I will say. And not a person on that island ever had had rickets that protected them. So they had gone into the history of cod liver oil, and that was well authenticated. So well authenticated that Dr. McCollum in the early days used to say, I'm going to investigate goose grease. If cod liver oil had such a renowned history, my mother always cured everything we had with rubbing goose grease on it. Now, he said, there must be something there that turns out to be a new vitamin. I'm going to do that. Well, so here was the pediatrics with well-authenticated relationship of an oil without knowing anything about what it did or what the relationship was. Here was Nina Simmons, who had kept these records so perfectly for years and years. I think it tells in that little reprint of Dr. McCollum's how many years the records represented, with everything recorded, autopsies, the details of the diet, everything. So in this meeting of Dr. Howland and Dr. Park, they said, oh, isn't it too bad that there is no animal research on rickets? If we only could get an animal. Oh, Dr. McCollum, I have the answer for you. So they went to work on a great big table. And this was Nina and Dr. McCollum. Nina and Dr. McCollum laid out all those books they'd brought from Wisconsin and all the things they had had for those years at Johns Hopkins. And they recorded everything on one column that had to do with yes or no on rickets, all the protein, all the salt, all the fat, every single item of the diet was summarized, organized in a way that Nina was capable of. Nina could handle detailed records, data, and so they had the whole thing, and they knew yes or no on rickets whether protein, no, protein was reproduced regularly, right down the column. Sodium chloride, no. Sodium chloride was represented right down the column with a yes and no on rickets. But when it came to calcium and phosphorus, you see, all that was in detail, recorded. When it came to calcium and phosphorus, there was an astonishing answer. You could have high calcium, low phosphorus. You could have low calcium, high phosphorus. All of that was up in the yes rickets column. Yes, rickets. But it didn't matter which way you tipped it. You could tip it either way, and the answer would be rickets. Then the other thing that came out very clearly that substantiated the clinical picture was that it made a difference what fat you had there. Sometimes butter fat would do it. but it was butterfat from one source or butterfat of a different origin. I can't remember whether Wisconsin butterfat was high enough to in its ingredients to really protect, but sometimes butterfat protected, sometimes it didn't. But following the clinical record, cod liver oil always protected, no matter how high the calcium was, no matter how low the calcium was in relationship to phosphorus. Sometimes butterfat, but always cod liver oil. Well, there was the picture. Then they selected a set. That's where Dr. McCollum doesn't make it plain that all this came out in the former records. He implies that they merely, out of their heads, they set up experiments. It was always on the basis of this long record that Nina brought out of years of work. And then they set up a few experiments. And Dr. Shipley had then developed by them an exceedingly accurate, exceedingly special kind of laboratory technique that would record tiny implications toward rickets, not just the great big bead along the rib, the great big frontal bones of their clinical study. They took samples, of course, at autopsy, and they tested the bones. Well, sometimes they wouldn't have had the florid, what they call the florid rickets, but they'd have a tendency to rickets. And any slight tendency to rickets, this test of Dr. Shipley would pick up. That is, the groin end of the bone, they would pick out from the rats in these new experiments that they set up. The groin point of the bone that might be, I think they took the leg bone, the groin point, put out a large band of cartilage, and then if they're just in 3 or 4 days, if the mates of this animal that had been killed and shown only this great bulge of cartilage, if this animal that was like it had received 3 or 4 days of cod liver oil, of course it hadn't made any visible difference, but with Dr. Shipley's test, I just remember the table filled with those little glass flat dishes where he then took the little hand microscope and would slip in those little glass dishes and we'd look. And in that cartilage, there would be a stained black, tiny little point. And then as the cure advanced, that would broaden and broaden. But just in those few days, the answer to the test was apparent. So different kinds of butter, different brands of cod liver oil, a wealth of things could be tested. Then Dr. McCollum, having found vitamin A in butterfat, could put the thing to a test because vitamin A was very easily oxidized. It could be lost if one weren't careful. I had to be careful in the preparations for Miss Simmons feeding her rats. I had to be careful not to, in the heating of this pound of butter, we filtered it and got just the oil to feed. We didn't take the whole butter. We took the pure oil. I had to be careful that that wasn't overheated and oxidized. So the cod liver oil was put into a flask, and for hours at a time, I bubbled through a stream of air that came up through the thing. Didn't hurt it at all. It was not vitamin A in a special richness. That was the problem at first. Could it be vitamin A with its special concentration? No, it wasn't. Oxidation did nothing to it. We fed it, and in just the 3 or 4 days' time, the little old black dots appeared in that bulge of cartilage, saw that it was a proven. So Dr. McCollum didn't wait. He named it vitamin D. Now, he didn't do anything further. He didn't have the, he started some experiments, but he didn't have the chemical know-how that Dr. Steinbach had. That, you see, the whole thing was left for Dr. Steinbach to do. Also, that irradiation conferred this vitamin D on materials. All of that was left for Dr. Steinbach. Plenty of research material for both Dr. McCollum and Dr. Steinbach. But oh, was Johns Hopkins simply thrilled to death. And naturally, it created quite a furor in scientific circles. My name is on the earliest. I came back to Wisconsin before this had gone very far, but the very earliest observations, my name is on, so I get sometimes letters from various sources, and this test of Dr. Shipley's is still being used every day out in the Research Foundation, and it's referred to as a Miss Parsons test. Well, nothing of the kind, but I am identified with these early days, not the whole thing. Did you want any further questions at this point? Because that's about all I have.
Well, not specifically on the technique, because I think that was very clear. There was something that you began last time, which I just want to clarify for my own information. You had said that Dr. McCollum had taken his notes with him, saying that it was his experiment after all, and had indicated that this had caused a certain amount of discomfiture in the person of E.B. Hart. Now, I recall that that McCollum had been accused of this very thing, of taking the notes, and he had insisted that, at least in his own book, that he had offered to leave a duplicate set of notes.
I'd forgotten that.
Was this done?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
But was it mainly Hart who was objecting at this point, or was
Dr. Steinbach resented it too, because he was very particular about things that belonged to him, and of course he had done some of the preparations, he had been involved in all this. He considered it a joint affair, not just belonging to Dr. McCollum, but it couldn't very well be divided up. I think that Dr. McCollum was right, that essentially it was his thought, his planning that went into it, and Nina Simmons, infinite care in carrying out all those experiments, so that I think he was right. I stand by that decision. I think it was correct.
That's good. I know that from the very inception of McCollum's stay at Wisconsin, he seemed to have the support of Babcock.
Yes.
What was he like? You know, you knew Babcock. What kind of a person was he?
Well, he was a great enthusiast. It was really wonderful to just hang around and see him beam with a smile all over his face as he would look at Dr. McCollum. Dr. McCollum was his invention. He was his dear boy. And there was a kind of a father-son relationship between the two. And Dr. McCollum, though he was a good talker, he was also an even better listener and intelligent. And Dr. Babcock sailed off into the blue about his theories. His theory went way beyond technique. He didn't have techniques. And to a certain extent, nobody there had techniques that would compass these things. And some of his thoughts, Dr. Babcock's thoughts, dealt with world-shaking problems, the cosmos. He thought he could solve all the problems of the cosmos. And so he had a set of instruments that were very delicate indeed, that would record earthquakes, but he wasn't interested so much in earthquakes, but in the universe. And so they, when they had the new biochemistry building, they built him a little subterranean office way, way down in the ground that he could go to by a series of steps. And there he tried to carry out some of those cosmic earth-shaking theories. I knew at one time something about the absurd things, but I don't recall any details anymore. And Dr. McCollum didn't believe in those far-out things, but he was a listener. And Dr. Babcock didn't feel he had another understanding soul in the world but Dr. McCollum. And while he came back to Earth and would talk about the things that Dr. McCollum could see any approach to experimentally, that was what Dr. McCollum got out of it.
Sure.
A good many of these thoughts, of course, Dr. Babcock made that machine, which you ought to go and look at, which twirled by hand, made out of little scraps of things he found around the barns, and it told the butterfat, and my, that put the university on the easy street.
Yeah, he was so modest about it himself.
He was a very modest man. He was a charming person, just wonderful. So to know him was just one of the things I prized. And of course, it was mainly just listening in to these two people before Dr. Babcock disappeared down to the infinite down below that would tell about the universe. They talked about more practical things first,
sure,
that I could understand.
How did he ever get interested in these cosmic philosophical questions?
Well, his mind was so alert. It's too bad when technique doesn't keep up. And now, let's see, what's his name in Canada? I listened to his lecture in Toronto. Oh my, he's earth famous. I'll think of his name directly. And he's reported to be the last physics professor that got his results with a string and a piece of wax, because he didn't have the technique to give up. He was the one that got into the beginning of the ionization and that whole new field. He had the whole thing in line with a piece of string and a piece of wax. He had only those modest techniques, and so he died before the great big breakthroughs, but he made the breakthrough, and he was admitted to have done that. His place in history is secure. But he wouldn't have gone any farther at all because he didn't have techniques. And yet he visualized those ions so that the essential part was there with modest technique. Well, Dr. Babcock did that butterfat. He could do that far, that technique. It made an enormous difference to Wisconsin. And he could accomplish that. But his mind couldn't stop at that. Just like this English man, His mind roved widely. He couldn't stop at just what his waxen string brought out, but he couldn't go any farther because he didn't have technique. And so you couldn't stop Dr. Babcock from getting into the universe and the cosmos because he had that kind of a mind. He couldn't stop. He went on and on. But it didn't. Nothing registered because he couldn't follow it up. That
it was largely speculation.
Speculation, that was all. But speculation about the butterfly or anything that he could accomplish. But as I think I told you, that a bas relief of him in the entrance to the lobby of Biochem, there's a bas relief there of Babcock sitting before the his very up-to-date balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys are always convulsed when they look at that. They said Babcock wouldn't have known any more what to do with that machine than anything. He didn't even know how to weigh something. You see, he could only do things in the rough. And so the modern boys resent that the artist made that. He should have had his machine,
his
old butterfat machine,
yeah,
in that bas relief. That would have been honest.
Sure.
This
sure.
bas relief was dishonest. So you see, that answers your question to a certain point.
And gives us some interesting insights into him. Thing that I find interesting in a way is that Babcock was so encouraging to McCollum. He seemed to have no deep prejudices about, you know, the nature of research. And yet, I read in Russell's biography that he wasn't liked a lot by farmers. He wasn't really a farmer himself. He was really interested in nitty-gritty research, as they say. Yet, when McCollum broached the subject of using rats instead of cows for experimentation, Russell was opposed. And his opposition seemed to be that, well, they're pests, you know, rats are pests, whereas cows are useful animals. I never could understand why he was
so
fine.
I saw it repeatedly in the great persons that came to our laboratory, that utter repulsion of the popular mind toward rats. Some of even the great that came into our laboratory would nearly faint when they saw those rats in the cage. That utter repulsion. You just would have to see those cases to believe it. Dr. McCollum couldn't explain his experiments to some of the people that he would so long to interest in the results that he got because of that nearly fainting condition when confronted with a rat. So
even little white rats?
Even those beautiful little white rats.
I guess that's just an emotional factor.
It is, but it just shows
strong.
How deeply, it's almost a folk thing. It's almost an instinct. So deep rooted. Russell was an interesting fellow. He was very narrow. As Dr. Babcock was broad, Russell had done this wonderful contact with tuberculosis in his foreign field, so that his interests from the beginning were narrowed. Anything that he used, any line that he did, he could see. He even could see home economics. He thought cooking was fine. He wanted us to be practical. He was sympathetic. That touched him a little bit. So he and Miss Marlatt got on famously. But His mind didn't rove abroad like Dr. Babcock's. It rested very narrowly with a certain predisposed set of interests. So he wasn't a very good dean, for he was all right up to the point that he served, but he couldn't have helped much in the years that followed.
You mean during the 20s or after he retired?
Yes, as the things developed.
Yeah, I know. He was in a lot of hot water, a lot of controversy during that time.
Yes.
Excuse me. Oh, we're doing fine. We still have many minutes left. excuse me. Just a small point. I know that when you went to Hopkins in 1916 or 17, that some other students went along too. And I have two names, Victor Nelson and Barnett Scherr. Whatever became of them? What role did they play in this?
Well, Victor Nelson got some kind of a semi-prestigious job after he left us. I can't remember just what it was, but he just kind of faded out. He wasn't a true scholar. Barney Scherr was one of the clowns of all time. Oh, we couldn't have missed Barney Scherr. He came right out of Russia and with a terrific name, and so when he applied for citizenship, the judge asked him if he wanted to keep that terrific name, and Barney said, well, not specially. What would the judge advise? And some way, Barney said, I want to be sure about something. I want to be sure. So the judge said quickly, be sure is the one you will be. Be sure. Now, what would you like for the be? And be sure said he thought Barney would be, Barnett would be a very good name for the be. Well, that's the background of him. He came, he was the clown. He didn't know he was so funny. He was, you would just die over that little fellow. He was a very short little boy. And he was going to succeed through thick or thin. He was that immigrant that had the America as the opportunity. And you never saw anybody. He was assigned a set in my remembrance of him there at that was here at Wisconsin. He was assigned certain tasks to do, and he had a whole set of ether distillations along here. There were flasks, a whole row of the flasks, and they wanted to distill off the ether that had brought out something out of its dispersal. So they wanted to condense this, and they wanted to drive off the ether, but they wanted to save the ether. So a condenser was put in there to condense the thing, and there was a safety valve up the top that the ether could get out of. Well, that was for safety's sake, and that was left open, deliberately left open. Barney, all day long, put a stool there by the desk, got up on the stool, then got up on the table where this outfit was, then reached over and got the stool and put it up on the table, climbed up on the stool, and took corks and put in that whole row of distillation. Well, it wasn't supposed to be corked at all. And one by one, the corks exploded. going all over the room. So Barney got down, climbed down the same way, went around the room, picked up the corks, put his stool here, climbed up, put his stool here, and went down the row and put in the corks. America was his land. He was going to succeed. If they put him to distilling that ether, he would succeed. So all day long, that little fellow put the corks in these in the distilling apparatus. Well, that's the way he went through life. He got a fine position for research down in Arkansas. So he became a big name in Arkansas. He published paper after paper, mainly worthless, terribly written. But besides being a comic, he had a kind of an appeal. People were kind of protective of him. The big heads of departments, like Dr. Sherman, Dr. Mendel, Dr. Mendel particularly, took little Barney under his wing. And so Barney would sometimes send his completed papers to Dr. Mendel, who would criticize them, put the English straight,
sure,
reorganize it, make the paragraphs right, and send it back to Barney. The Barney would send it into the Journal of Biochem, and it would be published. Observations on Baltimore as a wonderful experience. You see, it was history. And my little apartment hung out over the edge of the steep declivity down to the Gulf, and Fort McHenry was within sight. And there the flag waved, the history of the Star Spangled Banner,
sure,
was right there. Well, that was just wonderful. The cobblestones were between my street and Johns Hopkins. All of them were cobbled, and the carts and horses coming by made a fearful noise on the cobbles. In my block, those famous Baltimore steps were from one end. You see the little narrow houses, each had an entrance with white steps. Occasionally they were wood, but mainly ours were white marble, as it was supposed to be all during in that region. And the tradition was that the marble steps would be scrubbed every morning, and the wooden steps would be painted every third morning. Well, ours being marble, never a day but what those steps were scrubbed, with a woman down on her knees scrubbing those front steps. Absolute rigorous demand. You just had to have the front steps scoured. So tradition was wonderful. The hospital was all full of tradition. The great big foyer, the central part of the hospital, had a two-story image of Christ in the foyer, and circular steps going up around to the second, around that figure to the second story. And a cardinal, I can't remember who he was, a cardinal that was so famous, came and spoke to us from those steps. He was a leader in the World War. He was very famous. And our own cardinal there had his church and his house right across the street from the hospital. And it was spring when the tulips blossomed in that cardinal's garden. I don't remember names anymore. There were markets just a couple of blocks from Johns Hopkins, And in those markets, they were still selling the leeches, because all the physicians, many of whom were foreign around there, believed in the drawing of blood.
Mm-hmm.
And all those leeches were very hot sales all through that region. Oh,
my
yes,
God.
They were. The food was quite foreign, some of it. They were very fond of eels there, and they were smoked and dried. I was very fond of those eels. I took my market basket, and like everybody, I had an eel's tail sticking in one end, an eel's head sticking out of the other end of my basket.
Mm-hmm.
The market down at the end of right by the bay was wonderful, because that had the most marvelous array of seafood.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews were Orthodox Jews there, so it was a wonderful study. You got the old world traditions, the brass that was brought from all those old world countries were just priceless brasses, but the immigrants saw the beautiful shiny aluminum pots and pans, and so they discarded their brass. So we could go up and down and buy brass. They'd put it on these priceless old things. They'd put it on and sell you for the price of crude brass, the copper and brass. I brought some home. But the interesting thing was that the woman that would sell you the brass would have a lot of the traditions. She could tell you what this pot was
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm.
I got a great big pot about like so, and she said, I said, why is it so narrow at the top? And why isn't it just kind of an open pail? Oh, she said, that has a history. You know, in our religion, we can't cook anything on the Sabbath. We have to lay off of of any cooking. So we would die if we didn't have our tea. And so we take this brass pot and bring the water to the boil and then sit it on the back of the stove for over the weekend. And that little top doesn't evaporate very much.
Wow.
And then we said, well, now those old black umbrellas, do they have a history? Oh, yes, she said. Those old black umbrellas have a history. She says, now in our religion, we can go only so many steps from home on the Sabbath weekend. That, but if you take your umbrella, your old black umbrella, you can, when you've taken that number of steps, you can sit down on the curb, put up the umbrella, and you are at home. Then you can put the umbrella down, and then you can go that number of steps before you sit down on the curb and put up your umbrella again. That way you can go anywhere you want to for the weekend. Well, now, wasn't that a treasure to get these old customs like that from the woman selling us brass?
What was Hopkins like compared to the University of Wisconsin, the atmosphere?
Well, it was so conservative. You never knew where you would bump up against a no. Now, Dr. McCollum was, you see, he was in touch with Dr. Howland and Dr. Park, and they were much concerned about how many of the women couldn't nurse their babies, and they knew it must be the diet, so they wanted Dr. McCollum to study the diet. Well, the dietitian was a very able woman. Maybe you have heard of Pat O'Day here in Ball. Oh, the Ball crowd worship Pat O'Day's memory. Well, this is his wife, and she was a very fine, well-educated person at the head of the dietary department. And of course, she was inwardly involved.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
she couldn't. Dr. McCollum approached her to come on their study of the wards. And she said, oh, how I would like to, but I am not allowed out of this one corridor that comes from the outside to my office here. I cannot set foot.
So why was that?
Well, they hadn't done so before. And when my students, became students of hers to get their internship, they were not allowed to enter the library. That didn't have to be down those corridors. They could have gone around and entered the library from outside. They were not allowed to poke their noses in the Hopkins Library. They mentioned to Mrs. O'Day what book or reference they wanted. She would mention it to the head nurse. The head nurse was privileged. She had won her spurs. The head nurse was privileged to go into the library. She would get the book, give it to Mrs. O'Day, who would then give it to my students.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I mean.
That's rather
incredible. Well, I should say so. And you never knew when you were going to run into that. You just couldn't believe the block that would be put into your way. That's just no
Why do you think it was like that? Do you think it had to do with being so close to the South, and, you know, or what?
No, that it was old, and I suppose partly the endowment. I get Johns Hopkins and Yale. I guess it was Johns Hopkins, though it must have been Johns Hopkins, that had to build the elevator in a contraption separate from the hospital, because by the money that had been given them, there was a prohibition of ever having an elevator
in the building.
And so they built a separate building for the elevators, and you clumped across a wooden connection. Planks were laid down so that wheelchairs could be put in, and you could clump across. Well, I ask you, you just never knew when you'd run into history like that.
No.
Imagine that for a hospital.
Especially one with that reputation. It's amazing. When I think of the generosity of people who have bequeathed this university funds and, well,
but no
the story of McArdle, center is so different.
And no
yeah, it's just incredible. Yeah.
Well, strings were all over the place. But there were old customs that were interesting. I went to lectures. I went to very famous, world-famous people lecturing. And I can't even remember his name now. The head of physiology was so noted abroad. Every head of a department that lectured, and they didn't have graduate students doing the lecturing. The head of the department did all this business there. But they had what were called deaners, because, of course, most of these heads of the department had got their education in Germany. Germany was the place you went to get finished off. And deaner meant worker, you see. But the deaner was the man that was a satellite of this great big person. He set out all, he was a well-educated or a non-educated person, but he belonged to this head professor. He did all, he knew all the professor's lectures. If the professor couldn't be there, the deaner could give the lecture just as well. But he wore the white coat. But the amusing thing was that each deaner was so much a copy of his professor that all his mannerisms,
really?
The deaner of physiology was George, and George held his head at just the angle that the head professor held his head. He was an exact copy as far as
that's really funny.
Well, you see, that was again tradition. So everywhere went the tradition.
Why did you decide to come back to Wisconsin from that?
Well, I wasn't getting anywhere. Quite rightly, Miss Simmons was the big person to assist. I didn't have any objection to her. She was my student. I was proud of her. And about when it came to writing books, I could have helped with the writing of books. Miss Simmons had all that devotion and all of the perfection of detail, but she didn't have ideas. And so I could have helped very much more, but I was never invited in. I never knew when a book was being written, when a book was being revised, and that wasn't helpful to my career.
No.
And what I was allowed to do was so circumscribed, and I was repeating things over. So that when Mary Buell, who had taken my place, Mary Buell had been Miss Danil's assistant in Iowa, she came, when I left, she came to be to my place there. She wanted to fill a very fine place there at Johns Hopkins, not with Dr. McCollum, but with some other people. And she wanted to leave. And so the call came that I was to come back. And they considered that I was on leave of absence. I think it was even legally down that I was being loaned to Dr. McCollum.
I see.
At least that was the implication of Miss Marlatt. And she tried to, well, it was all right because I was ready to come back. And so I came back into my former place with, of course, an advance in salary and position and professorship and so on. So it was an enormous step up from the kind of under-assistantship that I was doing there at Johns Hopkins, not getting any place further. There was objection from Miss Simmons to my publishing that piece of research that I had thought up and I carried out, and there was resentment over
that. What was this?
The one on vitamin C being necessary for rats.
I see.
That made quite a splash. That was quoted in textbooks by Dr. Sherman for his Columbia people. It really was notable, and it was mine entirely. Dr. McCollum kind of blinked when I told him that I had this idea and wanted to carry it out. Oh my, he said, that's wonderful. That is a real research thing. So it really was. But Miss Simmons resented that I should publish it.
Do you think she was jealous?
Yes, I think so. She didn't have any cause to be, because she always was first. And I agreed.
So,
wanted to be entirely it.
Yeah, I think so. So when you came back to the University of Wisconsin, this, I imagine, gave you a great opportunity to do some real original
research. Well, yes, because you see here, there were no divisions set up, hard walls. That's a thing that again and again visitors to Wisconsin would exclaim over. Why, they would say, I couldn't anymore walk into a neighboring biochemistry department in my university. Why, I would have to finesse for years to get across. What you do? Why, you just march into every department on this campus and ask for what you want. And that was it. Now, Professor Hart was still adamant that there would be no women in his
department. He still was.
Oh, yes, that until his death, there would be no women in his department. But he was the most generous soul. Why, I owed a lot to him. He wouldn't have me on his payroll. But in those beginning years when I was feeling my way into research, I'd take a manuscript over to his office and I'd say, now I want some advice. What shall I do about this? I'm wondering how to manage this in my article. Oh, he said, I've plenty of time. Read it out loud to me, the whole thing. Now imagine that from the head of a department. That was the kind of treatment I got from Professor Hart. I never resented not getting on his payroll. Everything else was all right for me to do. And so that was wonderful. So I got some money even. I began to get money from the Department of Agriculture because we had an inspection every year. A woman came around, I can't even remember her name, she was quite famous, and she would come around from the Department of Agriculture, Home Economics, and she would inspect biochemistry and all the departments around, but she would come over to our department, and by that time I had some thoughts about what I wanted to do, and she'd ask me, well, could I give you some money for anything? And so I got some backing that way. And so I started out on various lines of work and published mainly in our little annual report. That to me meant publication.
Well.
And so that was quoted. So I began rather modestly, and of course I had a diet squad, you see, and I had all these fine students and graduate students that could be diet subjects, so I began in a very, very modest way on some lines like that. So it was a step up.
Yeah,
very much so.
Right, I know you came back as an assistant professor. That was.
I wouldn't remember.
I think I read that somewhere, so
that's
I assume
all.
It's correct.
Well, I don't remember those details. But but when Miss Zuhl came, Miss Zuhl just pushed. Up I went, salary and everything. I didn't care whether I stayed wherever it was I was. That didn't mean anything to me. But Miss Zuhl.
What was she like?
Oh, she was a hustler. And she meant to have that department reflect her. She was very much an egotist. But her egotism took the form of boosting all of our interests. Oh, very much so.
In other words, the whole department was embraced.
Oh, yes. And so while Miss Marlette had favored nutrition and biochemistry, Miss Zuhl took the whole spectrum under her wing, so I didn't get any special encouragement like Miss Marlette had given. I didn't need it because Miss Zuhl was back of me all the way. She was a wonderful head of a department. She could fight other departments to a standstill. The medical hospital organization wanted the hill beside us. She wanted it for that home management house and the nursery school. And they fought it to a finish. They appeared before regents. Oh, that feisty little woman. They were scared to death of her by the time she got through fighting them. There wasn't anything she couldn't fight for.
that she was head of the department?
Yeah.
What was Miss Marlatt's position?
Well, Miss Marlatt, Miss Marlatt had a rocky career. Her father, I think it was, that died when our Homemade building was just being built. And so she wasn't there when they played a trick on her and put the extension in as part of her building. This building was hers. She had got it, but it was extension and home economics over the door.
I see.
Which was an awful blow to her because she wasn't here to fight for it. And she was only a department of the College of Agriculture.
Oh, I see.
And so was Miss Zuhl, and Miss Zuhl came in. But that little feisty person wasn't going to leave it that way. She made us, as a committee, go over and interview the dean of the Department of Agriculture and tell them that she wanted to be the head of a college of her own. And that didn't do anything very much, but all I had to do was to mention it to Dr. Alvium how much she wanted. Dr. Alvium was a saint of home economics. He was just a generous, fine person. He liked Miss Zuhl. He believed in her fighting for her rights. And he saw no reason why she shouldn't be the head of a college all her own. He mentioned it, and of course Dr. Alvium mentioned it. It was different from our mentioning it
to
the dean. So it happened very speedily. And so when Miss Zuhl then went to these great big meetings, she was a dean of a college in her own right instead of just being the head of a department. So
must have been a real powerhouse.
Oh, she still is.
Yeah.
In retirement, she comes over for meetings. She's retired to her retirement home. But she comes over for meetings and she helps guide things from a very tactful distance. Mm-hmm. She still has the say-so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, surprised. I know that after you had been back here for several years, you went to Yale to get your PhD around 1927.
Yes, and I told you a little of the history of that, how Chisha Wong scolded me for not having got it. And I decided, well, why not, I thought. I never thought why so, but I thought, why not? And so I prepared in two ways. I noticed that everybody, when they got PhDs, had a good deal of physics. And so I took a summer session here of physics. And oh, it was the most enjoyable session I ever put in. Physics had never passed by my ken before, but oh my, the head of the department, I don't know now who he was, he's long ago retired, I suppose he's dead now, but a wonderful person, a wonderful teacher, and I just peppered him with questions. So once when he handed out he laid our quiz papers up on the desk and we took them as we went out. But this time he looked at the seat number which we had put on our quiz paper, and he delivered each quiz paper by going back and forth in the rows, and he got to me and he said, "Oh, it's you, is it?" said he, "that makes all the hundreds on our quiz paper and asks all the questions," said he. He had to have me identified. And so that was the first part of the summer, and the rest of the summer I went in their summer session down at the University of Chicago, because I thought that was where I would get my PhD.
Oh, I see. Well, when you were at Yale, though, you did study for a while with Mendel and Osborne, though, didn't you?
Well.
Or is that not true?
Well, it's a... it's a kind of complicated situation. There again, traditions. I went there because so many people were influential people told me that I ought to go there. See, the University of Chicago didn't pan out. They were not scholarly. They just weren't up to it. I could see that that wasn't the place I wanted. I was awfully glad to have had the summer there and got acquainted with them. Some of the people that had been there were really notable. Now that's clicked off for the end of the...
No, it's on.
Names are my leg. A fine woman who became then the head of the Women's College in Connecticut was the head of the department. She was just about to leave, so I wouldn't have had her.
Mm-hmm.
The instructors in the various courses were second rate, obviously second rate. I couldn't have studied under them, and so it was very obvious. And then as these influential people, the Martha Kena, with whom I had been closely associated in Dr. McCollum's laboratory, Martha Kena and I were the two people downstairs in Dr. McCollum's laboratory, and she had already gone to Yale for her degree with Mendel, and so I went thinking that it was with Dr. Mendel that I was taking my degree. I was very short-sighted in a way, because I got swept off my feet with all sorts of thrills with some operations on dogs that were going on when I got there to the department. I never had been in close touch with operations. I had leanings toward the medical school always, but I hadn't been in on operations. These operations were taking out kidneys out of dogs and rats, and doing various things to dogs. I forget all the series of things, but they allowed me to give the anesthetic. Oh, was I proud. I was the anesthetist in these operations. Well, good gracious, how could I leave that to do what Dr. Mendel, I interviewed Dr. Mendel, and he indicated what he would have me do. Sounded like nothing at all. It was something about the digestive tract, which I came back to later as an independent worker, but I thought nothing of it, and all these operations just thrilled me. So Dr. Smith was a person in his own right. Now that's the end of the...
Yeah, we'll have to finish this up next time. That
yes.
sounds